Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Presidential politics have been pushed to the side this week as many Americans mourn the death of former President Ronald Reagan. But that doesn't mean pollsters are taking time off. According to the latest Los Angeles Times poll, Democrat John Kerry is leading President Bush 51-44%. Ron Brownstein writes for the Times. And Ron, quick question first. Was this poll conducted before or after Mr. Reagan's death? And did that have any impact on the poll's results?
That was conducted from the 5th through the 8th, so it was during the period when this was dominating the news. It didn't seem to have that much effect, as I think you might expect. On the one hand, there would be a short-term benefit perhaps for President Bush because the focus on Reagan has burnished the Republican brand. It's a reminder of a successful Republican president. On the other hand, it's very clear both from this poll and anyone who's spent time out talking to voters that this is an election that matters to people. It's just hard to imagine that it'll be very much influenced by memories of a presidency that ended 16 years ago.
As you write, Kerry leads Bush by 51-44% nationally in a two-way matchup, 48-42% when Ralph Nader is put in the mix. He draws 4%. But it's not all good news for Kerry.
No, it's not. First of all, Senator Kerry really hasn't made that deep an impression on many Americans yet. We have one-third of those responding say they don't know enough about him yet to know whether he'd be a good president. Only about half think they have a clear idea of his domestic policies, even fewer on his foreign policies. Also, one of President Bush's core arguments clearly is penetrating. Voters are twice as likely to say that Senator Kerry flip-flops on the issues than to apply that label to President Bush. And as you know, that's been a central argument for Bush. On the other hand, what's boosting Kerry is a clear sense of dissatisfaction with the way things are going in the country, the classic threat to an incumbent president. And we had an absolute majority, 56%, said they wanted the country to set a new direction rather than follow the course that President Bush has pursued.
Which course are they referring to? Because as we know, the economic numbers have been terrific. There's more people going back to work. So
yeah.
What is the concern?
Well, interestingly, that question was a broad one that sort of encompassed both domestic and foreign. When we asked specifically about the economy, by about 2-1, despite the good numbers in the last few months, people said that President Bush's policies had hurt the economy more than they have helped the economy. Now, traditionally, there is a lag, as you know, between good economic news and the change in public perception about the economy. The White House is hoping that eventually some of these poll numbers catch up to what they've been seeing in the job numbers. The other problem they've got is that Iraq is such a cloud over the public mood now. I think the White House political strategists believe that it's influencing even perceptions of the economy and, for that matter, everything else.
Even though overall nationwide Kerry is leading Bush, in some key states, it's the other way around.
That's true and very important. President Bush, we polled as well in three of the states where they are spending the most time and money: Missouri, Ohio, and Wisconsin. The campaigns combined have spent over $40 million on television there. Kerry's image wasn't nearly as favorable in Missouri and Wisconsin in particular as it was nationally. There was more of a sense of President Bush as a strong leader. And in these states, the president had a pretty comfortable lead in Missouri. The two were tied in Wisconsin and Ohio. Most Democrats think they have to win both those states in order to capture the Oval Office.
Finally, just in a couple seconds, the election's 6 months away. Does any of it mean anything?
There's a lot of room here for these numbers to change. The two things that are important is that Kerry has more work to do in imprinting a positive image on the public. And secondly, this urge for change, this current, can gather momentum and become very difficult to reverse. I do think that that those numbers, the dissatisfaction with the direction of the country, the hunger for a new direction on policy, those are real threats to the president that he is going to have to turn around. In the end, it's more important for him to resolve the doubts about his own leadership than to create more doubts about John Kerry.
Ron Brownstein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ron Brownstein, reporter for the L.A. Times. Mourners continue to file by President Reagan's flag-draped coffin in the Capitol in advance of tomorrow's funeral. Other parts of the world are responding as well, including Central America, where memories of Reagan are decidedly mixed. This week, we've been looking back at the Reagan years. Today, the late president's controversial Central American policies. Some say Reagan's open and covert interventions in the 80s kept the region from becoming another Cuba. Others say he was an anti-communist zealot who funneled money and CIA support to vicious death squads that killed with impunity. Joining us on the line is Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at the Kennedy School of Government. Professor, could you please first paint the picture of Central America as Ronald Reagan took office?
When Ronald Reagan took office, the Sandinista government had taken power, having overthrown Anastasio Somoza, a dictator who had ruled there for quite some time with American backing.
In Nicaragua?
In Nicaragua, that's correct. There were also insurgencies underway in Guatemala and El Salvador as well. And this was seen by Reagan and by his supporters as part of a sort of communist onslaught on the Western Hemisphere, and that if it were allowed to continue, would eventually have far-reaching consequences throughout the rest of Latin America.
So how did the Reagan administration intervene?
They intervened primarily and most dramatically by funding the Contras in Nicaragua, a sort of private army of dissidents, and providing them with military support. We also gave considerable military aid to right-wing movements in El Salvador and elsewhere to try and suppress these various insurgencies.
Now, were the Sandinistas, the group that the Contras aligned themselves against, were the Sandinistas communist?
They had some Marxist leanings, certainly, and they had close ties with places like Castro in Cuba, although the degree to which they were ever sort of under Castro's control, let alone Moscow's control, I think was never very convincing. They were first and foremost Nicaraguan patriots, and however misguided their political views might have been, I think in retrospect it's hard to see them as having been much of a threat to the United States.
Right. And of course, the Reagan administration's support of the Contras was covert.
It was covert, except, of course, everybody knew about it. It was being discussed. It was debated to some degree in Congress, particularly as things began to leak out. Lots of the details were covert, and, of course, the infamous Iran-Contra affair is what ultimately sort of blew the whistle on the whole thing and led to the end of American support.
Which was, if you could just give...
The fact that we were basically... selling arms to the Iranians and using the money to fund the Contras as a way of getting around some congressional restrictions.
Well, today, many in Central America, as I said, are reacting. One woman who heads a group of people who died during the civil strife says Reagan's name is linked to the darkest dictatorships in the history of Guatemala. Salvador's president, Tony Saca, says Reagan helped the country in its most difficult moments. Daniel Ortega, the Sandinista who led Nicaragua from 79 to 90, and is still a political figure there, says that he hopes God will forgive President Reagan for his dirty war against Nicaragua. What is true in hindsight about the Reagan legacy in Central America, in your point of view?
I think the tragedy here is that although many people lost their lives as a result of the American intervention there, it ultimately did not have very dramatic effects on those countries. That is to say, the Sandinistas eventually were voted out of power in an election, not forced out by American military pressure. The El Salvadoran situation was settled by negotiations, not as a result of anything that the United States did. And we still face problems in other parts of Latin America, say Venezuela, with left-wing movements, in Colombia with drug lords. So it, in a sense, it didn't produce a huge positive benefit anywhere, and it did have rather tragic human consequences while it was occurring. Mm-hmm. It was a sideshow in the Cold War that ultimately had primarily negative effects on the populations in those regions.
Stephen Walt, thank you.
My pleasure.
Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at the Kennedy School of Government.
So far, a major airport, several roadways, even a mountain in New Hampshire have been named for the late president. And if the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project has its way, his likeness will soon replace that of Alexander Hamilton on the $10 bill. And all that could be just the beginning. Grover Norquist is director of the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project in Washington, D.C., and a longtime conservative activist. He joins us on the line from Washington. Welcome, Grover.
Glad to be with you.
Well, start by telling us about the $10 bill idea. How's that going? And what about poor Alexander Hamilton?
Well, about 3 years ago, I started talking to members of the House and the Senate, folks at Treasury, to get a consensus as to what would be the best way to honor President Reagan when he passed on. And there was some thought for the $20 bill, although President Jackson was a president. There was some thought for the $100 bill, but that's not normally carried by Americans, so perhaps that wasn't appropriate. And the consensus from everybody that I spoke with was that we should put Reagan on the $10 bill. Alexander Hamilton, who was not a president, has been on it since 1928 when he rudely bumped Andrew Jackson off the $10 bill. And having been on since 1928, we will no doubt find some other fun resting place for him on the $500 bill or something exciting like that.
Well, and actually there was an earlier attempt to put Ronald Reagan on the dime, but Nancy Reagan apparently didn't approve of that idea.
Well, actually, I went through this with the Reagan Airport. I get calls from somebody who says, oh, Nancy Reagan's not in favor of this. So I called Fred Ryan, who was Nancy's lawyer, and said, does Nancy Reagan have an objection to our honoring the president? And I was told, no, no, no. She asked, says, I'm not pushing it. And she does not want to be perceived as, you know, demanding honors for her husband, which she has not been doing. But it is important, I think, for Nancy Reagan and for the Reagan family, who are share Reagan's modesty, to have it understood. This is not some effort that they are pushing.
And Grover, I understand this isn't ending with the $10 bill. There's the goal to have something named after the former president in every state of the union, 3,000 counties, and in each of the formerly communist East Bloc countries?
Well, what we're looking for is something significant in each state. So there'd be a Montana statewide honor for Reagan, and then something in each county. And there are a little more than 3,000 counties in the United States. To give a sense of proportion, there are about 700 things named after John F. Kennedy in the country that you can find on the Geological Survey, and about 800 to 1,000 named after Martin Luther King. So with about 62 things named after President Reagan, we're not exactly getting carried away yet.
And how much are your efforts going to become easier now with the passing of the former president?
Well, when we started the Reagan Legacy Project, the goal was to begin a debate at the state level, the local level, the national level, about what should we do when Reagan passes away to honor him. As we started that debate, some people said, well, now that we've decided we're doing Reagan Airport, why would you wait? And they went and acted in 1998. So the goal has always been to anticipate Reagan's passing and be prepared and to have thought it through. What you didn't want to do was to have people think up something that was inappropriate. Now, let's rename Nebraska, or something that was inappropriately small, like a road somewhere, but rather to think it through. And that's how we came to the $10 bill after years of discussion. The answer is yes. I mean, I expect that states and counties and cities, we're getting lots of emails and calls in here from people saying, you know, you suggested a couple years ago that we begin to think about this. We've been thinking about it, and here's what we're looking to do, you know, with a building or a road or a school.
All right. Grover Norquist, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Grover Norquist is director of the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project in Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, more on the Reagan legacy. We talked to General Wesley Clark, who served under President Reagan and thinks President Bush took the wrong lessons about foreign policy from the Reagan White House.
And later, actress Andrea Martin. Critics and audiences loved her in My Big Fat Greek Wedding and now in Tennessee Williams' play, The Rose Tattoo.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
When President Bush eulogizes Ronald Reagan tomorrow, he will be saying goodbye to a man he sees as his ideological father. Comparisons between the two have been made many times, not least by President Bush and his top aides. Reagan's evil empire became Bush's axis of evil, as President Bush looked to the confrontation and subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union as the model for fighting terrorism. But former NATO commander General Wesley Clark, in an article published in May in the Washington Monthly, argues that President Bush has misunderstood the most important lesson of the Reagan years. Wesley Clark joins us on the line now from Little Rock, Arkansas. General, welcome.
Well, thank you, Gail. It's good to be here.
Let's start with your place in this argument and in this continuum, because you served under Ronald Reagan during those Cold War years. Did you see yourself as something of a Cold Warrior in those days?
Well, we were all serving the country. We knew we were under threat. We knew we had to rebuild the armed forces after Vietnam. And President Reagan came in. He did put more resources into the armed forces, and he made us proud again. He extolled the concept of service. And I remember when he gave the speech at Normandy in 1984, I was a colonel in the Pentagon and was listening to it on the radio, and it was just magnificent. I mean, people cried.
And in your article, you quote President Bush and aides like Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, who say that this administration has explicitly seen itself as following in Reagan's footsteps, but you believe that they took the wrong lesson from those years. How so?
Well, they fundamentally have misunderstood why communism failed in Eastern Europe and how it was that Ronald Reagan got rid of it.
Okay. Tell me more. For example, you mentioned that it was a result of popular discontent, that it wasn't democracy at gunpoint.
Reagan never believed that you could impose democracy at gunpoint. He knew that it had to come from the people themselves. What he believed is that we were dealing with a corrupt system that the people themselves were ready to push over, that they could see through it. And he supported efforts like a Polish Pope and solidarity and the work done to undermine the convictions and Marxism-Leninism among people in Eastern Europe. Democracy was ripe in Eastern Europe. They'd had a democratic tradition before World War II. They were people of the West. They were educated with the West. They read the same books. They participated in the same culture. They listened to the same music. And it was simply a matter of Ronald Reagan being strong enough and direct enough in what he said to be able to pose a challenge to the Soviet leaders that they couldn't respond to. And by the way, Ronald Reagan was never afraid to sit down with people he didn't agree with, as he did with Gorbachev. So the idea that you could march an army into a country and by force, throw out its rulers and stay there and then try to impose your way of thinking on a different culture, that wouldn't have been Ronald Reagan.
And in fact, you point out that it had been decades of very careful diplomacy that led up to the eventual collapse of the Soviet Union. It didn't happen overnight.
That's exactly right. And it was a matter of following through on the original vision of the architects of containment. President Truman, President Eisenhower. President Eisenhower had a chance to roll back the Iron Curtain by force in 1956 when the Hungarians revolted, but he didn't. He chose not to. In 1968, in the Prague Spring, there was another incursion of Soviet forces, this time into Czechoslovakia, and the West didn't respond by force.
Well, and as you point out, the U.S. never directly invaded any of the Eastern Bloc countries. Why is that such a critical difference?
I think it was hugely significant in that the West and NATO stood as an alternative to what was an oppressive dominance by the Soviet Union, so that when it came time to change, they could throw the Soviet Union out, and they invited NATO in because NATO didn't force its way in. The problem we've got in Iraq is the opposite. We're there. We forced our way in. It's going to be much harder for the Iraqi people to look at us and say, well, we really want you to stay. You really helped us a lot.
During the Cold War, was the whole moral situation as well as the diplomatic situation a little more clear-cut in that there was the Soviet Union, a superpower, there was the United States, a superpower, and perhaps it was a little easier to stand in solidarity with the Europeans and others?
Well, I think it was easier to see the distinctions of the two sides, because what we have to avoid here is the illusion that we're in the clash of civilizations. We're not in a clash of civilizations. It is not comparable to the Cold War and the clash of ideologies in the Cold War. What we're caught up with is we're on the periphery of a civil war inside Islam. So we've got to be very careful with these historical analogies, or we're going to completely misunderstand the nature of the conflict and then respond inappropriately. And I would argue that's what the Bush administration has been doing, is responding inappropriately.
And finally, General, would you share with us your assessment of both the good and bad elements of Ronald Reagan's foreign policy?
I think he was a man who could articulate a vision that brought people with him. But in practice, he was not bold. He was not decisive. He was cautious. He was prudent. He changed his positions. He was pragmatic about it, not doctrinaire, and appeared to be a leader who listened. So I think he may have sounded a strong moral compass, but he didn't always walk in a straight line, and that was the secret of the 1980s.
General, thank you.
Thank you.
General Wesley Clark joined us from his office in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The New York Times is reporting today that Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi may have tried to have Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Abdullah assassinated. U.S. and Saudi officials are actively investigating those allegations. And joining us on the line from New York is Patrick Tyler, a correspondent for The Times who broke that story. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Well, as you tell us, U.S. and Saudi officials have known about this, have been investigating it for some months. So what do they think they have?
Well, they think they have basically two participants in the conspiracy who come from two different directions, corroborate the same story that last summer and last fall, while the Libyan government was negotiating an end to sanctions and renouncing terrorism and agreeing to give up its weapons of mass destruction, it was also apparently running a covert operation to assassinate the ruler of Saudi Arabia and to destabilize the kingdom and try and overthrow the government.
Although it is, this information came out in part because of plea negotiations. Should that make us a little wary?
It should always make us a little wary. I think that again, we are in the middle of an investigation, but the part of the information that is coming out of the plea negotiations, what's important about this is that it's been corroborated by another witness the FBI has twice interviewed in Saudi Arabia.
One of the elements here is that at an Arab summit meeting just before the war, evidently the Crown Prince Abdullah insulted Colonel Gaddafi. What was that all about?
Well, I think there was some mutual insulting going on. This was the Arab summit in which the leaders were trying to come to a common position before the war. Gaddafi started the confrontation by basically saying that King Fahd, the ailing Saudi monarch, had invited the colonial powers and made a deal with the devil by bringing foreign troops into Saudi Arabia. I think Crown Prince Abdullah, who is the day-to-day ruler because the monarch is ill, was insulted by that. He, in fact, had secretly been helping Gaddafi get his skirts clean over the Lockerbie sanctions, using his diplomatic intercessions and channels to do that. And I think he was insulted, and he said to Gaddafi, "Your lies precede you, and your grave is in front of you." And you know, I think faces went red, jaws locked, and tempers flared. And that appears to be the basis of Gaddafi's anger and fury when he went back to Tripoli. According to the witnesses, he then decided he was going to undertake a covert operation to overthrow or kill Crown Prince Abdullah.
Well, to tell someone your grave is in front of you certainly does sound like a death threat. But is there a distinction to be made here, though, between terrorism and targeted assassination? Are the two really the same?
Well, the plot was bigger than that. Assassination was the beginning of it. The next step was to build cells to destabilize the government, to attack other members of the royal family, and to foment a coup to change the government. So, I think somewhere in there you're talking about a broad pattern of behavior, or at least the incitement for that, that suggests a terror campaign.
And, Patrick, how might this affect American policy toward Libya?
Well, that's the real question. I think the White House has pulled back from the engagement of Libya. It wants to get to the bottom of this, and I think it's going to have to play out over the next weeks and months to see where the investigation goes. There are a lot of lines out. I think the bottom line is that if this is determined to be a serious case of terrorism, it'll be very difficult to carry on with business as usual with Colonel Gaddafi.
Patrick, thank you.
Thank you.
Patrick Tyler is a correspondent for The New York Times.
The Army has admitted that the medical discharge of one of its soldiers was partially due to injuries the soldier suffered during training in Guantanamo Bay last year. Specialist Sean Baker told Kentucky television station LEX-18 that he was severely beaten by fellow U.S. soldiers during a training exercise in which he says he was instructed to play the role of an uncooperative detainee. Baker says he was face down on a steel floor when one soldier got on his back and began to choke him. Baker says he began to panic when he could not breathe.
And I gave the code word that I was told to give to stop the exercise, to index the exercise, which was red. The individual slammed my head against the floor, began and continued to choke me. And then I got enough air, and I had my head turned towards them, and I somehow got enough air, and I muttered out, "I'm a U.S. soldier."
The Army originally said that Baker's discharge in April was unrelated to the injury he sustained, but reversed that statement on Tuesday. Joining us on the line from Lexington, Kentucky, is Sean Baker's attorney, Bruce Simpson. Bruce, tell us, your client, an experienced soldier?
He is indeed. He served in the first Gulf War in the early 90s, volunteered to join the National Guard following the tragic events of 9/11, volunteered again to be on active duty shortly after that, and then, unfortunately, volunteered a third time for this assignment, posing as a detainee in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Yes, and for that exercise, your client says he was ordered to put on an orange jumpsuit, the same one that detainees wear, to go under a bunk in a cell and to resist when a team of U.S. soldiers, they're called the Immediate Response Force, came to get him. Now, you say that that team was not aware that this was a drill, but tell me first, the IRF, what is that?
These are five-man teams, these extraction teams. Each person is assigned a particular part of the body to bring into submission, and then one person's assigned to video the whole exercise.
What happened to the video?
The video, to the best of my understanding, was erased or destroyed.
Well, after the beating, Sean Baker began to suffer seizures. He was hospitalized, treated for traumatic brain injury, was given light assignment duty. Finally, this April, he medically retired, received an honorable discharge. He's now unemployed. As you know, the Army has issued statements on this case. Major Lori Arellano with the Southern Army Command told NPR that your client was told to cooperate during that exercise, implying that he provoked the other soldiers. Here's Arellano.
He did put up a fight. He did resist, which meant that the IRF team members had to also raise their level of force necessary to contain the situation to protect themselves and the detainee.
Your response?
My response that is a complete misstatement of the truth. If the soldiers had been informed that this was a drill, they wouldn't have beaten up my client, number one. Number two, my client was told to resist. The extraction team was told that this detainee had refused to come out of the cell, that pepper spray had been used on him to get him out of the cell, and that was not successful, and that this particular detainee had assaulted a sergeant prior to the extraction team going in. And just before the extraction team went in, there was an interpreter talking to my client in Pashtun. There shouldn't be any surprise that they're going to go in there and serious injuries were likely to suffer, and that's exactly what happened.
What does your client want?
You know, he really has not expressed any particular desire except to obtain the benefits that he is entitled to right now. He was informed that it may be as long as 18 months before he gets any money from the Army. That's unconscionable.
Bruce Simpson, thank you.
Yes.
Lexington, Kentucky attorney Bruce Simpson represents specialist Sean Baker.
Still to come, actress Andrea Martin.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Many who are not fans of the 40th president have felt that this week's coverage of the death of Ronald Reagan has been far too positive. Anna Herrick of Somerville, Massachusetts, spoke for many when she wrote, "It goes without saying that Ronald Reagan was an affable guy with an easygoing, aw shucks charisma. Nonetheless, I'll always remember Reagan for pushing the arms race to dangerous levels, establishing an economy where the rich got richer, the poor got poorer, and the homeless population exploded, ignoring the AIDS epidemic, and bankrolling death squads in Central America."
Kent Walker of Tucson, Arizona, thanked us for our interview exploring a possible connection between the rise in the number of sexual assaults against women in the military and the prisoner abuse scandal. He thinks even more could be done.
It's sort of known and assumed that it's a non-democratic and hierarchical system. It's sort of notorious for sexual violence and hazing, and what might be needed is some outside commentary in terms of congressional hearings to sort of get at the overall culture of the military.
Our story on elevated levels of a toxic fire retardant found in the breast milk of American women brought this email from Chris Mulford of Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, who writes, "My job is to promote breastfeeding among low-income U.S. women. Hearing about high levels of nasty stuff in mother's milk makes them worry. But all of our children, no matter how their mothers will decide to feed them, are already carrying a body burden of toxic chemicals the day they are born. The good news is that even though human milk contains contaminants, nothing else that parents can feed their children builds the immune system and aids development the way human milk does."
Margaret Kelly of Norwalk, Connecticut, wrote in response to a story we did yesterday on salary disputes in New York City, from home health aides to police officers. She writes, "I marched with the home health care aides in the city on Monday. I did not understand why, when discussing home health care workers, your host seemed very concerned about what the people inconvenienced by the strike would do. But when discussing teachers and police, there was a focus on their salaries and how they were too low to live on in New York. Home health care workers currently make about $7 per hour and are demanding a still low $10 an hour. If you think police in the city can't get by on $38,000, try being a health aid worker and doing it on $20,000.
Finally, Bob Kahm of New Hampshire wrote, after jazz critic James Isaacs referred to the late composer Henry Mancini's soundtrack for the 1958 Orson Welles film Touch of Evil. Bob writes, "Universal Pictures took Touch of Evil away from Orson Welles and recut the picture. Welles was only allowed to see his butchered work once and wrote an infamous memo with this reference to Mancini's now acclaimed score. I assume the music now backing the opening sequence of the picture is temporary. Ouch."
Well, we turn to our film critic, Eric Schaefer, who says, yes, that's true, and a big revival a few years back recut the film to Welles' specifications, including removing the music from the opening sequence. I thought Mancini's seedy, faux, south of the border music gave the opening a real charge. Well, you decide.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name and phone number and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I kind of like this.
Yeah.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
If you're just joining us, thousands of mourners are continuing to file past the casket of former President Ronald Reagan in the Capitol Rotunda today. President Bush is expected to pay his respects along with the First Lady tonight around 7. Earlier in our program, we heard from the director of the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project, Grover Norquist, who's trying to have the late president's likeness placed on the $10 bill and elsewhere, but not everywhere.
Is Reagan important enough to be on Mount Rushmore? The answer is yes. If the question is, are you spending your time going out and getting chisels and seeing whether the geology people say it can work, The answer is no. That's not on the list of things to do.
Funeral services for Mr. Reagan get underway tomorrow morning at 11:30. Here and Now we'll have live coverage from Washington, D.C.
Just the thought of actress Andrea Martin makes some of us smile. In the late 70s and early 80s, she starred in Canada's late-night SCTV. Second City Television was an invented broadcast network staffed by a group of young upstarts who would become some of today's funniest comedians. Martin Short, Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, John Candy, Rick Moranis, and Andrea Martin, whose leopard-skin-coated character Edith Prickly is now classic.
And now a word from SCTV station manager Edith Prickly.
Just finishing up some last-minute redecorating in my office. Scavullo took this picture. Moishy Scavullo.
Andrea Martin has also played memorable film roles in Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Wag the Dog, and My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Here she is as the brash, loving Aunt Lula.
He don't eat no meat.
No, he doesn't eat meat.
What do you mean he don't eat no meat? Oh, that's okay. That's okay. I make lamb. Come.
In recent years, Andrea Martin has turned to the stage and to drama. She won a Tony Award for her Broadway debut in My Favorite Year. Her latest role is Serafina, the Sicilian seamstress and devoted wife of a trucker in The Rose Tattoo by Tennessee Williams.
Buonasera.
Buonasera. There is something wild in the air. No wind, but everything's moving.
I don't see nothing moving, and neither do you.
Nothing is moving, so you can see it moving, but everything's moving, and I can hear the star noises.
That make the star noises, that termites eating up the house.
Tennessee Williams wrote the comedy The Rose Tattoo after spending time in Sicily. Now it's being staged at the Huntington Theater in Boston, and Andrea Martin is in our studios. Welcome.
Hello.
What a pleasure to meet you, and what a pleasure and pleasant surprise to see this play, because I didn't know that Tennessee Williams could be this funny and that you could be so wonderfully serious. How did you approach the idea of being in a Tennessee Williams play?
First, I approached it with denial, and then I read it about 17 times and kept listening to Nicholas Martin, our director, just to believe in me. And then I work with my acting coach in L.A. to, so much on script analysis, because doing Tennessee Williams demands more than just a superficial comedic glance at it. And so I took a long time understanding the symbolism and the depth of what he was writing.
There is a lot of symbolism. And the story is that her truck driver husband is killed in an accident. She already knew he was in the mafia. Then she finds out he was having an affair. She doesn't leave the house for 3 years.
Right.
I mean, it's tragic. How do you feel about Serafina? How do you feel when you embody her?
I feel just so thrilled to be joining the ranks of people like Maureen Stapleton that have done this part. It's like when you do Shakespeare and you're, like playing Mistress Quickly. And then you think about how many people over hundreds of years have played this part. And I know I talk about connection a lot, but that's how I feel when I do this play. Yeah. I feel connected to people who have come before me. and connected to a beautiful playwright. You know, actors don't get a chance to do that very often.
Did you study any of them? Anna Magnani was supposed to be Tennessee Williams' inspiration for the role, and she played against Burt Lancaster in a 1955 movie of the play.
Right.
Did you see it or not want to see it?
You know, normally I don't like to see anything I'm going to do, but I looked at it way back. I guess I really wanted to hear the dialect. I wanted to hear how Italian it was, how Italian it needed to be.
Well, you're a highly skilled actor. And by the way, have gotten tremendous reviews.
Thank you. Don't tell me any. Don't speak. I don't read any interviews. I don't like to know who's coming. I'm completely superstitious, like Serafina, by the way. That I can relate to.
And suddenly there she was, just a little bit. But I'm wondering, as that just happened, does... You know, given that you have played so many of these big, full parts, does Aunt Vula, you know, from Big Fat Greek Wedding, or Edith Prickly from SCTV, do they suddenly pop into your Italian Serafina?
I hope that they don't. I think I'd be doing it a really huge disservice. You know, I pop in, I guess, as much as I am in all the other characters you mentioned.
Yeah.
There's a part of me in this, but... I would like to think that this is much more dimensional, and for me, it's a deeper experience. I hope the audience feels the same.
They never came to my mind while watching.
Right,
but,
right.
But I'm just wondering if you're having to do, you know, accents.
Right, right.
Sometimes you just live in the Greek. No, wait, that's the wrong.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. It's very hard not to, if you're saying Tennessee Williams words. And, you know, I met with Eli Wallach before I came to do this play, and we sat and we talked a little bit, and I talked about accents. And
he starred with Maureen Stapleton.
And he said to me, you know, we never thought about accents, what I thought was just so revealing. I said, you didn't? He said, no, the poetry of the words will take over. And as much as I talked with a dialect coach and went to Sicily and went to Italy and really submerged myself, took Italian lessons, oh, my God, I was doing everything. And so I understand the vowels and I understand how to say Italian words. Really, the poetry does take over.
Can you give us one of Tennessee Williams' lines from the play with the accent?
I say, my husband had a rose tattoo on his chest. One night I woke up with a burning pain on me here on my left breast. A pain like a needle, quick, hot little stitches. I turned on the light, I uncovered my breast, and on it I see the rose tattoo of my husband on me on my breast, his tattoo. And when I seen it, I knew that I had conceived.
That's
Now we'll have people all across the country say, she calls that a Sicilian accent? That's the danger.
We'll get emails. I just want to ask you something about your start. Did you know, did you always know, I want to entertain, I want to be funny? Did you know that?
I knew that I wanted to be on stage. I didn't know that I wanted to be funny. I still don't know that I want to be funny, but along the way, I happened to fall into comedy, and then you fall into a niche, and you're kind of good at it, and that's all you're known for. So my struggle has been to get back to that genuine love I had for the theater. I just made a decision a few years ago that's what I was going to do, so I turned down things that would keep me in the same place, because when I cared less about the notoriety and the celebrity and what it was going to get me, and more about how I could evolve as an actress, you know, more doors open for you.
Well, we don't want to slam any shut right now, but I'm wondering if, keeping in mind that you are much more than Edith Prickly.
I'm not going to do Edith Prickly for you.
Darn. We love her so much.
Well, you can get the new DVD that's come out, and you can...
Is she gone from your life?
No.
Is she...
You know, I love her, but... you know, it's like I saw Macaulay Culkin, God bless his soul, interviewed on Larry King Live, and he was so charming and so dear. And Larry King Live asked him to put his hands on his face and do that scream that he did.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I look back on that, and I think it was another person. And I just don't want to be that other person right now. And, of course, all the things that I've done are part of who I am, but... you know, I need to move on and be present. And so when I have to go back and do those things, I don't know. It just feels Oh, I know I'm like making so many excuses. But you know what? Get the DVD. You'll see a lot of Edith Prickly.
Thank you for Edith. Oh, my gosh. And Vula with the Windex from the Big Fat Greek Wedding. And now Serafina.
Thank you.
And thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Actress Andrea Martin currently stars as Serafina in Tennessee Williams' The Rose Tattoo at the Huntington Theater Company in Boston. You can also purchase her performances in SCTV, now available on DVD.
And send me a check because I'm not going to make much from it. All right.
There once were seven people who started their own network, but every network has its day, and theirs was over, or so they thought. They were sick of doing comedy, but not that sick. One by one, they were summoned from their part-time jobs.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
By a force that none of them were able to resist. They were sent to New York City, the entertainment capital of the world, where they were treated royally and showered with adulation and attention. They were given the red carpet treatment and ushered into the...
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.